Welcome back once again to BadQuaker.com. It's Wednesday, June 22nd, 2011, and I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
And BadQuaker.com podcast is something we do every Wednesday. I wanted to clarify something, a mistake that we've been making at Bad Quaker with our audio files, and it was shown to me by a good friend. There's a little bit of confusion in the way they show up in iTunes because we have the podcasts, which are all numbered sequentially and all tagged correctly and all named right and everything like that. And then we have the interview series, which is still up on iTunes but numbered and named differently. And we have individual articles on audio file. And each of those is sort of randomly tagged and differently named. so they show up in iTunes in a sort of a crazy anarchical pattern.
No order whatsoever. It's just chaos.
So they do kind of show up randomly. So in the future, I'm going to start I'll work with the administration at Bad Quaker and see if we can't begin naming and numbering everything consistently so that we can maybe avoid that problem in the future. We're still going to have all the first stuff is going to be numbered wrong because it's already out there in cyberspace. But probably starting with this week, we'll try to get all the audio files and all of the interviews and everything named sequentially with the podcast so that it makes a little bit more sense when you look at it in iTunes. So,
I think at this point we're just lucky we figured out how to put them up on iTunes.
Yeah, that didn't happen by magic. we're not the most tech savvy among, even though our prime administrator works the tech field, and both Kai and I have experience with computers and in the tech field.
I was pretty technically savvy, like, a decade ago.
Yeah, me too.
but a lot has changed in the last decade.
Yeah.
I can make them look really pretty on Winamp.
Well, I can always make the excuse that my brain don't work no more.
I don't know about these newfangled technologies that the kids play with these days.
Speaking of a decade ago, and this is kind of something I wanted to bring up on a podcast a couple weeks ago, and we never got around to it. We got thrown off by that whole voting nonsense. But I wanted to talk about something that was a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago, and that was the loss of an entire industry, well, not an industry, a segment of an industry that never was. It was about to be birthed, and it was aborted and just thrown into a ditch. And that's some pretty graphic imagery. But that's what happened to the bizjet industry. I was working I was contracting to NASA in, I think it was 98, or I think it was 98, might have been 99. And we were winding down on a huge project that a lot of money had been spent on called the High-Speed Civil Transport. And the money, the government had just pumped unimaginable amounts of money into the high-speed civil transport. And when we got to the point of where we were ready to pull the trigger and we were ready to make this thing happen, they changed their mind and killed the program. And I could go into the details of why the program was killed and how Boeing came in and bought out the competition with the government backing. That's fascism. But I'm not going to get into that today. But either way, in the wake of this devastation of the murder of the high-speed civil transport, which I can clarify, to put it in layman's terms, it would have been sort of an efficient, functional, money-making version of that horrible French-English menagerie that was, what was their supersonic transport called?
Oh,
the Concorde.
Yeah,
the that flying death machine, the Concorde. That flying black hole of sucking money.
That, you know, no airports would let that thing land there.
Yeah, our our project at NASA was to create an airplane. Initially, we were looking at a Mach 8 airplane that could fly from New York to, like, Sydney in a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And it was doable. And then they started saying, well, how about if we do this? Well, how about if we do that? And they kept changing the plan and changing the plan and changing the plan. So by the time the government really figured out, by the time NASA really figured out what it was they wanted from us and what kind of a plane that they wanted, they decided, well, they've only invested how many billions into the project. We'll just stop it now.
Yeah.
And so there was all this this vast amount of intellectual energy that was all concentrated in one, it wasn't one physical location, because we had groups working on this from coast to coast, and we had people in England, and we had all working on the same project, and then NASA just cuts it off, and all this intellectual energy focused on this one thing, and it just gone.
Yep.
And sorry, that sound probably just blew somebody's headphones out. But anyway, it was just gone, just like that. Overnight, they told us, well, wrap everything up, lock it down, we're done. Engineers were laid off with days of warnings. And whole programs were shut down. Millions and millions of dollars worth of research had been done, and it was just literally locked away and shoved into closets and lost.
Mm-hmm. And that's not unique to this specific project.
No, that's how the aerospace industry works.
That's how any government project works, because they don't have to be responsible with their money, because it's stolen money.
Yeah, absolutely. So the direction that we were going to go at that point in time, or I shouldn't say that we were going to go, what I should say is the obvious direction that all that intellectual energy was going to focus on was something called the biz jet industry, which was business jets. What we were looking at, and there was a lot of potential money to be invested. There was a lot of people very excited about this. There were companies ready to take off in every direction with this idea. And the process was going to be the mass production of small, say 4 to 8 passenger business jets.
Mm-hmm.
These would be manufactured really super inexpensively compared to like the big,
the 747s.
Well, even compared to the current business class jets, which generally start in the millions. Mm-hmm. When you start to buy one. We were talking about planes that were going to sell for under $200,000. You know, these are going to be planes that a private pilot could afford to take out a loan and buy one and start a business and essentially have a taxi service.
Right.
From one minor airport to another minor airport, totally avoiding the big hubs. And this wouldn't be just for the exact... Right now, currently, the only people that ride in private jets are, you know, the top-level executives in business.
And, like, Al Gore.
Yeah, of course. But what we were looking at, as an absolute, it was coming right at us, and we were the intellectual power that was gonna build this industry. We're looking at stuff where your average businessman who needs to get to Cleveland from wherever, you know, one town pops into my mind and another one fails to, Minneapolis. Let's say you've got a businessman who wants to get from Minneapolis to Cleveland. Well, he doesn't want to deal with the main airport in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and he doesn't want to deal with the main airport in Cleveland. He can get on a regional airport that's nearer to where he lives or nearer to where he works, and fly to a regional airport that's nearer to where he wants to land, and yep. He doesn't even have to deal with the big international airports. And he can do it for a fraction of what he can fly on Delta or whoever.
Yeah, because there doesn't need to be the cost to keep these huge corporations running.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to pay baggage fees, and you don't have to, you know, there's none of this.
Right.
You don't have to pay for this huge jet to take you to these huge airports.
Yeah, we were looking at really small, really efficient jets, and we were looking at using the technology that we had developed in the high-speed civil transport program, and we were going to make jets that were affordable, for the little guy to buy and set up his own taxi service. And so a business, a medium-sized business, could afford to, rather than, you know, it would allow business to expand out. Smaller businesses that can't normally compete with the big guys, now they could afford to send their people out to further out, to expand their business out.
Right.
Because renting an air taxi to hop from one small regional airport to another would suddenly become financially viable. And owning that air taxi would be viable. And this, by using these small hubs and using a glitch in the federal aviation regulations, you bypass a bunch of the federal regulations.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice because if you have a medium to large sized corporation, they they're sending a lot of people on planes frequently, instead of paying for tickets every single time,
mm-hmm.
they just invest in an airplane.
Yeah.
And then they have the ability to send out however many they want, however often they want.
Yeah, and a company could even, the way that we were hoping to bring these in as sales, a company could buy one, and even if you don't have a pilot, because if you're paying $200,000 for a plane, that's pennies. If you look into what planes cost, $200,000 for a plane is nothing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's not even that much considering if you bought a fleet of actual road vehicles.
Right.
$200,000 is not a big investment for a company. So they can buy a plane for $200,000, but you can't afford a pilot because the pilot's going to cost you $200,000 a year.
Yeah.
But with the process that we would have, it would open up such a big market for pilots that you would literally create all kinds of jobs so that there would be a practical free market in pilots.
Right. So, as opposed to now, which if you want to be a pilot professionally, you pretty much have to work for the government.
Yeah, they're almost all ex-military or, you know, it's really a restricted entry mm-hmm. becoming a major airlines pilot. And it's not a fun job.
No.
I think a lot of, if you talk to a lot of the major airlines pilots, if they could get out of it and get into a small regional thing, a lot of them, I think, would do it. You know, at least of the ones that I've spoke with and dealt with. And the nice thing was, you're dealing with federal aviation regulations. You're dealing with something called Part 135 of the federal aviation regulations instead of the more stringent standards that the big airlines are under, which is Part 121. And so, because you don't have this burden of regulations, you can function so much cheaper, mm-hmm. and it would have just, the market would have just exploded, and there were a lot of people ready in 1999, 2000, there were a lot of people just really amped up and ready. The tech bubble hit, and that kind of hurt our market a little bit, but because a lot of people lost a lot of investments at that time frame. But all it did was it kind of slowed down the biz jet market by one step.
Mm-hmm.
So by 2001, we were expecting to really take off, but something happened. When September 11th happened in 2001, and the nation decided that we needed to go and attack a dirt poor little country that didn't even have its own functioning, I mean, the government in Afghanistan was almost non-functional.
Right.
And assuming everything that the government tells us is true about 9/11, and assuming everything the government tells us is true about bin Laden, and assuming everything the government was telling us about Afghanistan was true, did we really need to do what we...
Right.
I mean, you know, really, couldn't a couple dozen guys, if you just... How much did we spend in Afghanistan in the billions? I have no idea.
Yeah.
But if you'd have laid $1 billion, no question asked, reward?
Bounty.
Bounty on bin Laden's head. And by bin Laden's head, I don't mean arrest him and bring him in. No, bring us his head. If you had just been brutal and honest and said, this is the guy we want, we'll give $1 billion to anyone, no questions asked, and we'll give them complete immunity from any laws that they break in order to accomplish this, bring us his head, $1 billion, I guarantee we'd have had his head in about 2 weeks.
Or, you know, we could have asked the Afghanistan government if they could expedite
it. Well, sure, that would have been handy too, especially since they actually approached the UN saying, the U.S. hasn't even asked us to extradite him. And maybe if we'd have just asked. You know, sometimes...
Did anyone think to ask?
It's kind of like, you know, when you think about, hey, my neighbor has got that really neat tomato plant in his backyard. I would certainly like to have some tomatoes. Well, how about if you just kill everybody in his house and go take his tomatoes?
Right. Or, you know, you could ask.
Oh, ask. That was it. Yeah. We could do that. Anyway, but that rant was entirely unexpected, but anyway. So what happened instead was we got embroiled, embattled, where you get all wrapped up in something, embroiled. Anyway, we got all wrapped up in two wars, and the companies that would have...
I don't like words. There are too many of them.
The companies that would have been the primary builders of the biz jets, which was companies like Northrop Grumman and GE building engines and Boeing and General Dynamics, and these companies figured out that...
Somehow.
Yeah, strangely enough, it's more profitable to sell way, way, way overpriced old products that the government is already buying from you to support war operations,
mm-hmm,
than to develop whole new markets and take a risk on that new market.
Yep.
And, you know, from a business point of view, that's smart. It's,
right.
It's smart to go ahead and go to Washington, send your lobbyists in and go, you know, you really need to bring Iraq into this war too,
right?
You know, because that's good business. It's a lot safer for a business to invest capital, because that's what they have to do. They mm-hmm. to produce a product, they have to invest capital. So it's safer for a business to invest capital in something that you know is a guaranteed market,
right?
Rather than taking a risk on a brand new market that might or might not take off,
particularly when. If the government wants you to develop something new, they'll foot the bill.
Yeah, and oh man, I don't even want to go into how that works. That's a whole podcast right there on the unbelievable scam of how the government. If the government wants you to develop, I'm looking at a coffee cup sitting on my desk. So if the government wants you to develop a coffee cup, no, you know what? I'm not going to go into it. It's seriously a whole podcast on how ridiculous that process is of the government getting a company or a series of companies to develop a product.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not going to go into that today. But for a company, the risk that of developing something on its own as opposed to a guaranteed sell to the government, it's a dramatic difference.
And it is a risk. It's always a risk when you develop something new to put on the market, because the market is entirely unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
And people say that and they're like, oh, you can't depend on the market. It's totally unpredictable. But you cannot, there are products that when they began to be developed, investors went, yeah, absolutely. The public's going to love this. And then it came out and it totally flopped.
Right.
And the market,
Edsel,
had no desire for that whatsoever.
New Coke.
But then you have other things that the market, you know, the investors were like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
Silly Putty.
Nobody's going to buy that.
Hula Hoops.
You cannot market that.
Pet Rocks.
And yet, they take off.
And you have first-hand experience with that.
I do, yes.
Working Renaissance, the Renaissance circuits.
Yeah, I spent, I don't know, a couple of years kind of hippieing around the country being a Renaissance festival worker. And I'm not sure how you can do that and not become a capitalist. You get just such in-depth knowledge.
And that's
knowledge.
A real capitalist, meaning the real meaning of the word capitalist.
Right.
Not the guy with the top hat and the bag of money. And
right.
Not the fascist.
Not the fascist. But we would spend all week trying to come up with products carefully tuned to what our market wanted. You know, we would get feedback from our customers. Hey, you know, I really like this, but can you make it like this? And so we would, you know, we would make things like that and spend tons of time and energy making them. And they would sit on our shelves for years and nobody would buy them. And then we would have what we called a kids' day, which is where the local schools bust in hundreds of children.
Greasy little children.
And we would go, okay, well, we need something to sell them. Well, here, we've got this little trinket. We'll put it on a necklace. There you go. Make tons of them. Sell them for 50 cents each. And you can't keep them in stock, you know?
Yeah.
And it is entirely unpredictable. The things that we made that were just, wow, that's hideous. Nobody's going to buy that. We're gone in like a half an hour.
Yeah.
And the stuff we carefully crafted didn't move.
Or a whim can come through. Somebody can see one person wearing some odd thing, you know, they're wearing fairy wings or whatever. And the next thing you know, everybody in the festival has to have fairy wings.
And that happened. We would see things that would ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one person takes yarn and puts it on an elastic band for people to wear in their hair, just out of the blue, you know, because they had leftover yarn. And the next thing you know, every single booth has it in their booth, and every single person walking around has it in their hair.
Yeah.
And then, at you know, 2 weeks later, nobody wants to buy that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as soon as you've made a huge stock of it, it's over. Nobody wants that. They want, you know, face painting, or they want something else.
And that's really the purest form of capitalism. If you want to see real capitalism, go to places like Renaissance festivals or flea markets that are not harassed by the locals, by the local county or whoever.
Yep.
That comes out and ruffles through their stuff and checks out their paperwork and whatever. Go see farmers markets that are spontaneous, that just pop up in places where there is no organization and there is no, you know, it's just people and a true free market. And that's what you see. You see the complete randomness and the beauty of real capitalism.
Yeah, and it's completely not biased.
Mm-hmm.
I can make, you know, I can come up with an idea for a product. I can make it. I can sell it out of some little cart that I've got on the side of the pathway at the fair. And I can make as much money in a weekend as the big company who's at every single fair, who has all of their clothing made in China. And you know, I can make the same amount of money as they do.
Yeah. It's true competition.
There's no, you know, there's no monopolies. There's no
favoritism.
Yeah. The market will pick what it wants, not what you want it to pick.
And this is why socialism can never work.
Mm-hmm.
Because no central planner ever can predict what the market wants.
Yep.
And no central planner can predict ahead of time what needs to be produced for the market. And no central planner can ever, and Mises has, I've said this so many times, you know, if Mises spent his whole life pointing this out, and it's so obvious once you understand it. No one can predict prices. The market can produce prices. And so if you have any type of a socialization or any type of a central planner who's trying to predict what the market's going to want or predict what the market prices are going to be or anything like that, then you're guaranteed destruction because there's no possible way to predict these things.
And people have a tendency to think, even capitalists will fall into this. They think that prices have to be set by how much you can make the product for.
Right.
And then you add in your profit. And that's not how prices are set. I can attest to that firsthand.
No, if the market will not carry a price at a specific level, then it doesn't matter what the thing costs, and it doesn't matter what profits or not profits are there. If a price is too high, it's not going to sell. And if the price is too low, sometimes it won't sell.
Oh,
because
yeah.
people say, oh, well, it's trash.
Yeah.
You know, they won't even consider it. Or, you know, if the price is too low, the surge will come into it. And if the price is controlled by a central planner and the price is set too low, then all of a sudden you've got a shortage because everybody bought it out.
Right.
And then everybody wants it. And this is why things like the Soviet Union, they were so baffled by things like the production of nails was just baffling to the central planners because they didn't know how many this size nails and how many this size nails and how many this size nails. And so they would think, well, you know, the central planners say we need to produce 100,000 nails. So instead of producing what the market wanted, they would produce 100,000 nails of a particular size that was easiest for them to produce. And therefore, they've done what they are not going to get hauled out in the middle of the night and murdered.
Right.
You know, the problem is that particular size of nail is not useful in the market.
Right.
So you'd have people who were trying to build houses or in other ways use nails, and they had no nails that were suited to their needs.
Right.
So you had a glut of nails and a shortage of nails at the exact same time, and no central planner could predict these things.
Yep.
Or shoelaces and shoes. You know, we sit around and we think, well, obviously you produce the same amount of shoelaces as you produce shoes. Doesn't work that way.
Nope.
You know, shoes don't last a predictable amount of time. Shoelaces don't last a predictable amount of time.
Yep.
And so you can't plan it. And because of that, you're either, you know, there's a glut of shoelaces or there's a glut of shoes.
Yep.
And then, of course, the government starts lying and putting up signs that says, there's plenty of bread.
Yeah.
There are no bread shortages. I'm here for my bread. Here's your toilet paper. I didn't want toilet paper. I wanted bread. Tomorrow we have cabbages, maybe.
it's when you start to actually really look at it, the market is a beautiful, amazing thing that is really kind of like a wild animal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You can try your best to make it happy, but it is entirely unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know? And it may recognize you and just absolutely adore you one day, and the next you come out to try to feed it and it wants to bite your head off.
That's business.
You know? And to participate in that takes a level of adventure that is kind of daunting, actually.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why in a true free market, the entrepreneur plays such an important role. You know, we think of who is the entrepreneur. Well, nowadays we think of like somebody who tries to start up a business, and we appreciate them as an entrepreneur. But in a truly free market, every businessman, period, is an entrepreneur. Because in a truly free market, there are no major corporations with state advantages like there are now.
And in a truly free market, it self-regulates how big a company can get. Because once a company gets too big, it begins to get very bureaucratic.
Right.
Anybody who's worked in an office knows this. You know, the people who are on the floor selling the things know that, you know, it needs to be done this way. But by the time that gets up to the corporate level, it doesn't matter what the actual business needs.
I'll give an example of how stupid corporations can be. And it's not because people are stupid in the corporation. It's this corporation's structure that produces stupidity. Because the corporate structure is fascism.
Yep.
Okay, but here's my point. drive into a Taco Bell or somebody else like that. Taco Bell is notorious because they went through a phase of this, and I don't know if they're still doing it or not, but you pull up to their speaker at their drive-thru, and a voice comes out that says, "Hi, would you like to try our new stupid sandwich?" And it's not even the voice of the person who's working at that store.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're hit with this as soon as you pull up. It automatically plays. And so you're having to justify what it is you're trying to do or buy, or you're answering questions. Wait a minute, I'm being barraged with questions. I just looked at the menu.
Right.
You don't know whether to answer this voice that's not really a person who's there, or you don't know, you know, it's a very awkward moment.
And if you say, yeah, I'd like one of those, then the person who is actually on the radio talking to you is like, what do you want?
Which special are they running today? And I don't really know what the production is of something like that. I don't know what it actually produces. But I know this. I never buy what they push at me like mm-hmm. that. Years ago, I worked for Domino's Pizza. And they would have us answer the phone in specific ways. Thank you for calling Domino's Pizza, home of the extravaganza. Would you like to try an extravaganza? Well, you know, if you don't know what that is, no. The answer is no. And most people on the phone are not going to say, "Ooh, what is that?" Because they've called with something in their mind. That's why they called. They didn't call just, "Hey, tell me what I should buy today."
Right.
Sales doesn't work like that, you know? I mean, there's some people that are like that, but the vast majority of people, when they call someone to order something, they know what they want before they call.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a thing that was happening, whether we're talking about in the drive-thru at Taco Bell or whether we're talking any other setting like that where somebody on a high corporate level has come up with one of their genius ideas and then they rain it down to the people below them.
Yep.
And the people below them are stuck with this idiotic thing that they have to say every single time. And it doesn't produce what the guy up on the top thinks it would. Because
mm-hmm.
he's completely out of touch.
Yep.
So in that sense, a little company can respond to the consumer's needs, where a big corporation is run like a government. It's a bunch of people with top-down authority who are not in touch with the things that are happening below it.
And, you know, there is a certain amount of people, there's a certain legitimacy to people saying, oh, well, you know, the free market's very unstable and you can't trust things to the free market because it's so unstable. But it's unstable only if you're looking to make a predictable amount of money off of one thing forever.
Right, right.
And if you're willing to constantly innovate, if you're mm-hmm. willing to constantly push yourself, if you're willing to pay attention to what people want,
yeah,
then the free market will always help you. It doesn't matter if you are, you know, standing on the side of the road selling oranges, or if you're in a multi-million-dollar company.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. You have to constantly be changing and adapting to the way that the market is.
Let me use cars as an example. I think I've used this before on a podcast, but I'm not sure. But I say this with frequency. The government decided to get heavily involved in the auto industry starting, most people don't realize this, but starting in the 1930s,
mm-hmm.
the government began to get its tentacles into the auto industry. And has more and more over the years continued to get its tentacles into the automotive industry. And there's this codependence between the automotive industry in the United States and in Canada and in Mexico and in even countries like India, where they have a slightly freer market than we have in the U.S. But still, there's this bizarre marriage of industry and government. That's fascism. But I'm trying to make that a catch line, by the way. But this bizarre marriage between the auto industry and government kept the market making and mass producing and selling cars. Cars that may or may not have been what the public wanted.
Yep.
And my generation, you hear people say all the time, "Where's the flying cars? I was promised flying cars." There are no flying cars. There will be no flying cars because the government is never going to allow true market innovation. If there were never the industrial advantages that were given to the corporations in the 1920s and 1930s, if those specific car companies were not picked out as winners, and if the government did not give them advantages in the market, and if there would have been open competition in a true free market in transportation in the 1920s and the 1930s and all the way up to present day, I'm not saying there would be flying cars. I'm saying there wouldn't be cars.
Right.
I don't know what we would have, because you can't go backwards in time, cut off the government,
right,
and then go forward through an unpredictable market and predict what things are going to be like.
And I know we're running out of time here, but I just wanted to say that if you have to look at, you know, everybody right now wants energy efficient cars. They want good gas mileage on their cars. They want, you know, clean cars. And yet those cars do not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
And when they do make them, they're way overpriced and nobody wants to buy them.
Right. In any other market, when you look at any other free market, if the market demands something, then companies rush to fill that demand.
Right.
And yet you don't see that happening with cars.
Yeah.
Because that's fascism.
Fascism. Well, have we about hit our time limit?
I think we have, yep.
Okay, we've been way going over here lately, so we're going to try to keep this one somewhat reasonable. We do appreciate you listening to BadQuaker.com podcast, and we hope that you'll visit BadQuaker.com. Leave us feedback. We have a lot of articles on BadQuaker.com, and Kai's written some articles, I've written some articles, and we've blatantly stolen our articles from other libertarians. And there's quite a bit there that you can read. And we also just really want to express that, give us an email. We'd mm-hmm. like to hear your feedback.
Us on Facebook. Comment on our Facebook page.
And that's Bad Quaker. What's Facebook?
Just search Bad Quaker.
Search Bad Quaker on Facebook?
Yeah.
I don't know these fancy new things. I guess Facebook is kind of fading, I understand.
Oh, yeah? I haven't heard about that.
Anyway, but leave us feedback. Like us on Facebook. Send us an email. Mine is Ben, B-E-N, at badquaker.com. Kai is Kai, K-I, at badquaker.com. If you have something, suggestions about the website, if you have problems with the website, that the administrator there is badquaker at badquaker.com. So, you know, let us know what you like, what you dislike, what you hate about us, what you like about us.
If you like the new catchphrase.
Yeah. We promise it won't be fascist. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to us. Be sure and check us again next Wednesday. We try to do a podcast every Wednesday, and there are other audio articles that are available as well. And I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
Thanks a lot for listening, folks.